hppodcraft.com.
They put a comments box in the break room of my old job. You know, things you might feel more comfortable addressing about the workplace anonymously. And I just wrote, take a bath on a sheet of paper and slipped it in there because I'm a child. And if you put a comments box out, I'm not going to write anything productive in there. But luckily, our listeners are grown-ups.
Thank God.
And they have some things to say about our stories from last month.
Yeah, that's right. This is our comment show covering our shows from October. So let's jump in, starting with The Hospice, parts 1 and 2. Illegal Structures writes, Aikman is often compared to M.R. James, but I think he has much more in common with Walter de la Mare. Both excel at using subtlety to powerful effect for making the mundane seem eerie and disturbing. James's stories, on the other hand, are almost always predictable and formulaic. A strange artifact, something weird in a church, a hairy mouth with teeth, wash, rinse, repeat. I agree.
That's true. I gotta say, though, I'm a big new wave industrial music fan, and if I'd have seen an album that said Illegal Structures on it at any time, I would have bought it. That is the most new wave band sounding thing I've ever heard. Patrick O'Whedon writes, thank you for affirming I'm not the only one that has failed to get to the great writers. I only started reading Ligotti last year, and although I'm still seeking out the more obscure stuff, I bought an old New Yorker of eBay for one story. Oh, wow. I've almost gotten through almost everything. Happy you brought another apparently excellent strange author to my attention. And I haven't read any Ligotti either, honestly.
Patrick, I have not read Ligotti either. Yeah. Everybody tells me I need to, but I'm stuck in the turn of the last century here. I don't really get out to read much more modern stuff. I mean, Michael Che.
I've got some of his books.
Yeah, but you haven't read them yet.
No, I haven't got. I just assume that as part of our jobs, I'm going to get to it. Although Ligotti's still alive, so that was not a in a bonus episode or something like that.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe. I don't know. Well, I'm not even sure how old he is, so he might be a younger guy, as far as I know. Christine McCann writes, Aikman didn't click for me at all, sadly. For me, the effect wasn't pleasantly creepy or intriguingly uncanny, but just sort of off-putting and nonsensical. It's interesting to hear the show and reflect on how something uncomfortable or odd may elicit shivers from one reader, but a mere shrug from another.
But the shrug is funny. See, I can like someone something, and then if somebody hates it, that could be very funny to me. I don't know why.
Christine, you're totally entitled.
Yeah.
It's a purely subjective thing on whether or not you like a story or if something's going to trip that trigger in your mind. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. You know, this, I can't argue it with you. But for me, it does it. It makes me feel like there's stuff going on that I just can't quite get my head around. And that is what's exciting for me.
Yeah. Aikman. But it's still funny to hear you call it off-putting and nonsensical. It's sort of like, you know, like I love Star Wars,
yeah,
but I enjoy no genre of comedy more than making fun of Star Wars. So it's odd. It's that kind of thing.
She goes on to say, still, I always find the shows entertaining, even when you read something I don't personally like. It's one of the lovely bonuses of listening. I get great enjoyment out of stories I otherwise wouldn't. Service we offer.
Rob Graves writes, Chad, in regards to your crying hotel worker, I've worked nights on hotel reception for 7 years, and more often than you'd believe, the booking sites will overbook us and take the money for those bookings without anyone at the hotel having a say or the power to issue a refund directly. The British public are very quick to anger, especially in the early hours of the morning. I've lost count of the number of times people have literally made verbal threats on my life or become violent over a mistake I did not make and cannot undo. I'm a big guy, and I've been pushed to my mental limits before, too, all for minimum wage. Hell, sometimes I wish a mysterious hearse would come take me away for eternal peace and quiet. Oh man, I get that for sure. It was a weird occurrence, mostly because I didn't understand what was happening.
Yeah.
I figured it was probably a romantic breakup issue or something like that was going on. It seemed like a call like that had maybe just happened. But I am astounded at how people treat service workers in general.
Oh, God.
It really blows my mind, especially, and it's usually for something, you know, they're just trying to manage, but they don't have control over these things.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in that position as well, and it just sucks. But I definitely, even I could be so furious. I'm still not going to call somebody who's telemarketing, which I used to do, basically, and or somebody who's at a phone bank or customer call center and abuse them. Like, no, what did they do?
Never.
But people really fly off the rails, man. I just saw it yesterday. Yeah. Dropping my car off. I'm not going to tell the story because the story is somebody got mad.
Marcus Lauer writes, there's a study by S.T. Joshi I came across a couple years ago entitled The Modern Weird Tale, where he talks about Robert Aikman, among others. Strangely enough, he singles out Letters to the Postman, a rather obscure Aikman piece that isn't found in any of the readily available collections. When I read Joshi's attempt at plot synopsis, I thought that this couldn't possibly be what the story was about. It took me some time to find the story, and it is actually as strange as Joshi made it out to be. It is kind of baffling to imagine someone sitting down and meticulously writing a story like that. A critical habit of our times is the description of plot mechanics in books or movies as following some sort of dream logic. But I think Aickman is one of the very few creators I've come across where this statement might actually hold true.
It does feel very dreamlike, in that you know there's importance attached to things, but you don't know really what it is.
Yeah.
Which happens in dreams all the time. Rafe Ball writes, here's another possible reading. It's a vampire story. I thought this was great. The hospice is a vampire home staffed by Renfields. Everyone's rooms in pairs because it's one vampire, one victim. They're fed copious amounts to help recover from the blood loss. Hence, it's a necessary recuperative. Some may be willing victims coming for food or companionship and be repeat guests. Others need more persuasion. Hence, the fellow shackled to the table and may be more disposable. Crommy is used to bigger jobs. Operating a backhoe, perhaps? There's a somewhat Harkery feel to Mayberry's frustration with the over-the-top hospitality that he, in very English fashion, like Harker, feels forced to accept. Bannard's reaction to Mayberry's wound also reminded me of Dracula's when Harker cuts himself shaving.
Oh, yeah.
I think the pajama suits thing in Bannard's room is another thing that supports this interpretation, as well as the lack of windows. Mayberry notes the many pairs of identical pajamas, and when he sees all the suits in the cupboard, he doesn't make the same observation because Bannard's victims leave behind the suits they come in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's the thing. It totally could be that. Yeah, and we just caught the edge of it and nothing was explained, because that is always an horror thing. Somebody comes in and knows everything, the Van Helsing character, and explains everything to you. But absent that, man, this is some confusing stuff. You go into Hotel Vampire.
Yeah.
But it makes sense. The reason it was so hot in there is because vampires are always super hot. So that's another point to support that.
Tuguska Event writes, Weird Studies makes a compelling case for the hospice as a fairy realm or some sort of fairy incursion into our world. But the Weird Studies thinks everything is fairies. Fairies all the way down.
FB writes, okay, as someone whose very elderly mother has been in care facilities for over a decade, when I read the story, I immediately thought, well, he's got dementia and he's in a nursing home and close to death. I mean, his name is Mayberry. It might be possible that he had an accident, had to stay there, recovered, and then was released, but I definitely think it's a nursing home. Everything that happens mirrors the experience of old people with dementia in nursing homes. They are unsure exactly how they got there. They are unsure exactly what kind of a place it is. It's decorated in a sort of fake luxury hotel style. They have regimented lives. They can't leave. They get roommates who disappear and are replaced and are sometimes unsure of who exactly they live with. At mealtimes, they eat in a common room and are always encouraged to eat more, even though their appetite is low. They have erotic dreams and fantasies about the staff and others, and they often think terrible crimes are happening. They forget how to do ordinary things and get frustrated when they can't do them. Concerns about how they're going to pay for it all are common. They often believe they're going to go home soon and are worried because they believe their late spouses are waiting for them there, and try every day to return home, often asking visitors to help them. This is a really unsettling story for anyone who spent time in care facilities. I think the author spent some time in an old folks' home visiting loved ones. It's just too dead on to be anything else. And before I get showered with well-meaning messages of sympathy and concern, my mom has been lucky enough to avoid almost all of these disturbing symptoms, is quite happy and secure, and knows who everyone is. But having talked with lots of other residents in the place she's lived, this really rang some very unsettling bells. Wow, man. I kind of can't believe we missed that.
It wasn't just us that missed it, because I forwarded that to Jeremy, and this was his response. He said, what a great reading of it. So bloody obvious, and yet it never occurred to me, even given my dad was in a care home for the last 4 years of his life. Your listener is a smart cookie.
I'll tell you, man, because I didn't think, for me too, the absolute worst part of this last couple of years of the pandemic for me has been we had to move my mother into a nursing home remotely. But it's hard enough that I don't even want to talk about it. So obviously, I think my brain is shutting off thoughts about that as well. So I completely missed it, even though the title of it is The Hospice.
Yeah. Ethan Cordry writes, okay, everybody, tell their weird hotel stories in the comments. Here's mine. I was on a school trip in England, and we went to Tintagel in Cornwall to see some Arthurian legendary sites. Half of us stayed in a tiny seaside hostel, and half of us stayed in a local hotel. I was in a local hotel. When we arrived at the hotel, every single wall was covered in oil paintings, abstract things, big splashes of bright colors, and not very good ones. They were somehow a little too cheerful, sort of Jackson Pollock meets Thomas Kincaid. How can a totally abstract painting be vapid, yet That's what they were. After we checked in, we went over to the hostel for a little party. On our way back to the hotel, we encountered a black cat that walked across our path. And then as we rounded the corner up to the hotel, we saw a full moon hovering over the Irish Sea, shining blood red. We all joked it must be some sort of portent. It wasn't quite bedtime, so I went to the hotel lobby. There, again, surrounded on all sides by these insipid paintings, we encountered the hotel's owner, lounging around in a red crushed velvet smoking jacket and yellow slacks.
Whoa.
He proceeded to ask us a great number of questions about our trip in a very excited and intense manner. And then he began to explain to us how every person was 300 trillion years old and how with proper training, we could learn to recall every instant of our past existences by learning to control how our memories are stored in the physical spaces surrounding our bodies.
Go on.
In the course of his lecture, he explained that he and his business partner, who had painted all of these oil paintings and whom our host called the world's greatest living artist, had created their hotel to carry out the traditions of King Arthur's Round Table, the Sultanate of Harun al-Rashid, and the American Founding Fathers, and that he had learned how to choose his next reincarnation so that he could leave all of his wealth to his future self, and a number of other very interesting theories regarding magical springs, labyrinths, Hollywood movie financing, and the like. They were both very proud Scientologists. Okay. Mm. After an hour and a half of this, we decided to partly... Hour and a half?
Oh, yeah. When I said go on, that's because I know these things. It always sounds like, well, this is going to be an interesting conversation to have with this person. They're really crazy. And then you go, oh, yes, but we're going to be having it for a very long time.
A long time.
One direction.
Later on that night, one of my friends, roused from sleep by intense cigarette smoke drifting up from the room in the hotel lounge, strolled out onto the back lawn where she beheld a human figure draped in a white sheet walking along the edge of the cliffs above the sea. She felt it was best to go back to bed.
Oh my God.
When the morning came, we piled into our tour bus and got the F out of there. Wow.
Whoa.
I wish she gave us the name of that place because I think I'd like to visit it.
Yeah, me too. That's some Isle of the Dead stuff happening at the end there. Scooby-Doo stuff.
Yeah.
Peter Larson writes, Chad, the way to remember Unheimlich is to recall that the Unheimlich maneuver is when you help someone dislodge the thing they were choking on, but afterwards you both find the thing extremely inconvenient to describe. I thought he was going to go with, you pick the food right back and lodge it in there again because you've decided they should choke. Joseph Dawson writes, we can see Jeremy Dyson along with others who give a nice little talk about Aikman and then offers up a YouTube clip.
Yep.
So if you check out our comment section, you can see that.
I've watched
Steve writes, a BBC radio program about Aikman follows that up, and there's a clip there as well.
That's really good. Yep.
So we have a couple of links if you want to check out more of Jeremy's stuff talking about this author. Sean Days wrote, I've been praying for Aikman since I started listening in high school. I'm so glad to finally hear you guys reading his stuff. I highly recommend The Swords as well as pretty much everything he wrote. Started listening in high school. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Also, you were praying for Aikman in high school? Wow. That's an advanced Sean. I don't know if I would have known what was going on in those stories in high school.
Yeah.
It would have been like when I read Less Than Zero when I was in junior high. It just kind of made me feel sick. Matthew Buston writes, Chad and Chris should have mentioned Jeremy's play Ghost Stories, which I saw twice and was amazing, particularly so if you love Amicus Hammer's portmanteau films, M.R. James, Aikman, etc. It was turned into a movie eventually, which is good, but the play was something else. 300 to 400 people terrified all at once.
I saw the movie.
I haven't watched
it. It's enjoyable.
The movie yet. Yeah.
But Greg was telling me about the play, which he hasn't seen. He just read about it, and it sounded amazing. Like the stuff that they did in the play, they didn't do in the movie. And
right.
I don't know if he's ever going to do it again. I'm going to talk to Jeremy probably next week or something like that. So I'm going to go, dude, are you guys going to do it again? Is it going to happen? Because I really want to see it.
It's kind of like that one day you and I just sent clips back and forth to each other of people in Peter Pan productions crashing out and running into the set. And just laughed. That was pretty good. But if I could actually be at one of those productions when that happens, how can it compare? Into the School Friend, parts 1 and 2.
Yeah, Chip Cannon writes, I don't know, gang. I enjoy a certain amount of ambiguity in my fiction, but I think I prefer a strong narrative to hang the plot upon. Your H.P. Lovecrafts and your Grant Morrisons are more my speed, where there are some things left open-ended to let your imagination play, but you've also got a strong story besides. Listening to the episodes, which I enjoyed, I feel compelled to add, it sounds like you guys are writing the other half of the story for Aikman. That's more work than I'm generally inclined to do for an author. Clearly, in testament to Aikman's skill, you guys are along for the ride because I've heard you do otherwise for worse stories. But I'm not sure it's the type of thing I would want to read on my own. A little like Dune, just to be topical.
Just to be topical in almost any decade, by the way, of the last 40 years, but sure.
Well, the movie just came out.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a Dune head. A Duner? Dunester?
Dune dude.
A Dune dude. I'm a Dune dude. So I would, man, I could talk Dune. If we do a bonus content, I don't know if it's weird enough or strange enough. Yeah, it is. Hell yeah, we could talk about it.
Oh my God.
Especially when the God Emperor stuff, because that is freaking out there.
That'll be one of those episodes where I go, because I'm on the opposite end of the spectrum. I think Dune's cool because one of the scenes was in Phantasm. But otherwise, whatever.
But what you're saying, Jim, yeah, I know there's a bit of us writing the other half of the story for Aikman, but that's what's so good about it, because it makes me want to do that.
Yeah.
It hooks me and it gets my imagination going, and I'm like, well, what about this? What about that? If the story's getting me that involved, it's doing its job.
Jim doesn't want to do that. He's lazy.
Of course. And that's fine.
That's what that comment was, just to let you know that he's a lazy person. But not so lazy that he can't turn on the TV and see the Dune's on.
I don't think that's what he was saying at all.
No, it could have been any story, and Jim would have been like, let me tell you something, I'm a lazy man. No, he's not.
But Jim, I'm sorry it's not quite your bag, but I appreciate your writing, and I like hearing people disagree with us. I think that's interesting. So please, don't do it all the time, obviously. But
no, I like hearing that he's happy for us to write the other half of the story, because that's, even if the story is really well plotted and written out, we're still coming up with ideas about Dracula cooking chicken and stuff. That's just what we do over here. Richard Horstman writes, we recently saw The Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane, a movie about a 13-year-old living on her own and trying to keep any adults from finding out. Just struck me that you could turn The School Friend into its sequel with just a few tweaks. Mm-hmm. I talk about that movie all the time, actually, but I always call it 70s Home Alone, so probably people don't know what I'm talking about. It's Jodie Foster, and yeah, that's the plot.
Oh, it's Jodie Foster. Mm-hmm. I've never seen it. Yeah.
It is disturbing. Martin Sheen plays a pedophile in there. And
oh, God.
Yeah, it's the 70s. That's why I call it 70s Home Alone, because
it's dark.
You can't watch a movie from the 70s without at some point going, I think I need to throw up or take a shower. Yeah. Or both.
Really bad. Things got really dark in 70s movies.
Yeah.
Marcus Lara again writes, Aikman is the master of suggesting that there might be something deeply awful and depraved going on without actually giving the reader anything to put their finger on. I feel like this is an extremely rare talent to have. Another name that comes to mind is Kafka. It is easy to be deliberately vague, but 99% of the time, it just comes off as pretentious and fails to invoke any real apprehension. Interestingly, some people seem to feel this way about Aikman as well, but for me, he strikes the perfect balance. I agree. Darth Pseudonym says, I just wanted to comment on the discussion of the she doesn't know she's beautiful trope. While I, schlub, have a chance with her, maybe part of it, I've always read the trope as more of a sexist take on women. The thought that if she knew she's beautiful, she'd be a manipulative harpy who uses her beauty as a weapon. So by saying she doesn't know it, what they mean is she's beautiful but kind. On the other hand, there's truth to the trope too. Young women are bombarded by advertising and social structures that constantly shout, you aren't good enough, you need to do more to be perfect. And there are indeed a lot of very pretty women who have internalized that so much that they can't feel attractive. The thing of, when I look in a mirror, all I see are my flaws. So I don't know. Life imitates art, imitates life, I suppose.
I don't know if art is the reason for that low self-esteem issue, though, necessarily. It bleeds into art. Certainly when you see the trope of a pretty woman knowing that she's beautiful and doing awful things, a vain person, I guess, that you'd be worried about turning into that type of person.
Yeah.
But mostly it's advertising that wants to tell you you're a dirtbag, because how else are they going to sell products if they don't do that? So
you need this thing because you suck.
It was funny in the middle of saying that a movie would show a pretty girl. Well, wait, now hold on a minute. There's nobody that's not good looking in movies. So good looking people do everything in movies.
Yeah.
Even get treated like they're ugly for some reason because they're wearing glasses or something. Rafe Ball writes, really enjoyed Aiktober, guys. Great stories and great episodes. There's a definite tension in this story that you captured nicely when you said that that you can see the argument that this story is a bunch of nonsense, but it's not, though. There are strange threads woven through it that keep it hanging together and give it a tantalizing, frustrating feeling that there's something there, some kind of explanation, just out of reach. I keep looking for some connection between whatever's going on in the story and Greco-Roman myth. We get repeated references to myth, antiquity, and the geographical area. Petronius, nymphs, the Hellenes, the Cyclades. Cyclades, sorry, I think that's right. The strange vaulted ceiling of Tesla's library that Mel notes resembled a tomb could be a tholoi, an ancient type of beehive tomb found in Crete, and Sally's bestial thing baby snuffling around in the dark put me in mind of a newborn minotaur.
Oh,
what is Sally's baby? Is it a legacy of her father's spectral abuse? And what is its connection with the nursery from which something tore apart all the woolly animals and smashed the nursery door down to escape long ago? How could Sally have been pregnant? Presumably in the early stages, as it took a test at the hospital to discover, and then a child be born within a matter of weeks in a manner you'd never dream of.
Yeah.
Like in the hospice, the main character loses consciousness, here faints, there falls asleep, and when they regain it, they are confronted by a changed, aged, drained, or death-like version of the antagonist, who then assaults them, in Bannard's case, by invading Mayberry's physical space and with invasive questions, or in Sally's case, actual assault. The protagonist then escapes, back into sleep for Mayberry, fleeing the house for Mel, and when they next see the antagonist, they are back to their normal self, casting doubt as to how real the interaction may have been. Was it actually Sally Mel encountered in the house? When Mel says, "Sally, it was you," Sally answers with a question, "Who do you think it was? It's my house." And then asks Mel, "Will you please return my keys? My house, my keys." That could be Tesla answering. What is the curious way she is dressed, about which Mel will not say more? Is it her old school uniform? Is it a burial shroud? Is it Sally's dead mother? Hence the massively altered bone structure and voice. And the baby upstairs is Sally. Is Mel interacting with the past? Is Sally both her own dead mother and the beast baby? Why is she wearing steel-capped boots? Whatever explanation, if anyone cobbles together from the scraps and hints Aikman cast before us, Sally's comment toward the end rings true. My father left me more than I expected. Damn straight he did.
Yeah, great analysis, Rafe, as always. Ben A. writes, I have a few additional interpretations. The unlocked doors in the house are perhaps the transgression that opens the way for the strangeness of the second half of the tale. Perhaps the open doors are both metaphorical as well as a literal apertures for the horrors of the tale to creep in on Mel. The story takes on a stark turn once she enters the house to investigate. Her desire to see the library, a reinforced oubliette within the house, also delivers a creepy undertone of impropriety within Sally's home. Was her father a prisoner, or was Sally? Did this represent occurrences that are supernatural or horrifying but mundane? There's a starkly Lynchian quality to this girlfriend. I wouldn't be surprised if Lynch were a fan. I like Lynch's work, especially the dark undertones in Twin Peaks or Mulholland Drive, the diner scene. Whew. The tale is very unsettling, and its imagery is hard to shake. I think it's because Aikman's writing exists in a space between the completely surreal and the commonplace. Like Twin Peaks, there is a sinister subtext about Sally and her father, perhaps involving emotional or sexual abuse, or maybe something more supernatural, or both. Also like Lynch, the end of the tale is very dreamlike for Mel. Did she simply fall asleep in the house, a place Aikman suffuses with psychic terror and menace? That might explain why Mel contemplated burning the house down, especially if she divined the truth of the horrors that had occurred within. Was Sally's appearance at the end of the nightmare? Is Sally real, or a projection of Mel's subconscious? As you note, there are too many interpretations to count. What an interesting tale. I'm a convert.
Wow. Well, hey, you know, I mean, that's a testament to the story that it's gotten people to write such developed, interesting takes on it. You know, we don't normally get this level of analysis, and I love it. Sanjay Matthew writes, this has nothing to do with horror, just in reference to the throwaway quip about running a tab. You remember I said, in oldie timey days, you just run a tab with everything.
Yeah.
I always used to wonder about the old-fashioned running a tab for everything concept, down to Victorian novels where everyone seems eternally indebted to their tailors, etc. I wondered how business was practical if this was the norm. Anyway, I asked about this on our Ask Historians, the subreddit for Ask Historians, and the answer is fascinating. Apparently, part of it is down to the seasonality of income. In a still only partially industrialized society, agriculture was still the main economic driver for the wealthy, since land rents were ultimately their main source of income. And this meant that while you might not have ready cash on hand, there would be an influx of income around harvest, which is when you'd ideally pay off the larger bills you ran up over the course of the year. So if your status and reputation meant people perceived you as being good for the debt, they'd let you run a tab.
Oh.
So there you go.
Wow.
That's fascinating.
Very, very cool. Thank you, Sanjay. The Toddling Chaos writes, Rachel is such a great reader. She is. Christine McCann writes, I commented on the hospice that I didn't really like Aikman, but your positive comments on the story inspired me to give it a shot, and I'm so glad I did. This story really worked for me. It has the right balance of concrete details and ambiguous mysteries that have me thinking about it for a week and eagerly awaiting your thoughts on the second half. I guess I need to check out The Swords next. you do.
Christine, we had read her comment when she was lukewarm on it earlier. I felt that mm-hmm. that might happen with some people where the hospice wouldn't quite do it. It's so random, but yeah. that the school friend definitely, to me, I thought this is going to hook in the weird fiction.
Yeah.
Folks. Jeff C. Carter writes, Robert Block is going to hear from my lawyer's ghost. Jeff C. Cartober will not be denied. Oh, man. This legal battle is going to stretch on forever.
His lawyer's ghost.
A lawyer's ghost has got patience.
Oh, yeah.
They will tie you up in appeals for centuries. Stacey Schumacher writes, these stories are my kind of unsettling tale, and I'm definitely looking forward to reading more. As for this story, one thing that popped into my head is Mel discovered the torn items in Sally's house, and then when she hears the snuffling, sees her looking ragged and gaunt, was that it was a twin or hidden sibling, kind of a Hugo to Bart Simpson. Yeah. And when she makes the comment about having a child in a way not dreamed of, that phrase had so many interpretations. Through a horrible but sadly real-world situation, through her father's actions, through some type of strange ritual or creation mm-hmm. of a clone or homunculus, mm-hmm. that phrase reminded me of the relationship between Laura Palmer and Donna in Twin Peaks, when Laura kind of taunts Donna with the glimpses of darkness she knows about.
Mm.
That's true, yeah. She knows yeah. more. At first, it seems like she just understands there's a whorehouse across the river and stuff, and then you go, wait, no, she's tapped into some yeah. primeval force. I see yeah. the comparison to Lynch's works. These have been strange and dreamlike stories this month, and I enjoy the ambiguity. The Toddling Chaos writes, just wanted to include this. By the way, guys, the name change is a smart move. I was wondering if the old name might have been boxing you in a bit. If it means you feel freer to bring us more great content like Aikman and Saki, I'm all for it. Crom! And you know, one more thing about that, a lot of people are saying, oh, I'll miss the old show name. We have our reasons for it, but another thing that's very practical is just the 300 episode limit on our feed now that we've moved over to a new service.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to fill that up and it's going to be stuff from the old show, but then we need to switch over to a new show so all of those old Lovecraft shows are still free for you, etc.
Yeah.
So there are
yeah.
some practical reasons for us to move on to a second show as well.
Yeah.
And it's to
yeah.
your benefit.
We're going to be spreading our wings and Chad and I are going to be happier exploring more different, interesting stuff. I think you guys will too.
Yeah.
Comments 42, just what monsters do sometimes. Aaron Eskenazi writes, spent all day today going through Cults of Cthulhu. Definitely one of the books I've most looked forward to, and it did not disappoint. I was especially tickled with your use of Rachel, Andrew, and Chad as example GMs. That got quite a chuckle out of me. Edit, stumbled on Anthony Tedesco doing his best Tom Cruise impression, and is it me or do a few of the esoteric Order of Dagon leaders look like our wonderful hosts?
Wait a minute. See, I haven't seen the book yet, so you're, you're telling me stuff. This is interesting. I'm going to have to
yeah.
check all this
so
out.
So there's a big section of the book, Cult of Cthulhu, which I did mm-hmm. for Chaosium with Mike Mason. There's a whole chapter on making your own cult, and I go through all the steps and you know what you need to think about and your cult leader, and there's some tables. Like if you don't have ideas, you can roll on the tables to give yourself ideas. And I have three examples going through each thing, and of the different examples, one's Rachel, one's gotcha. Andrew, one's Chad. They're very different types of cults to kind of show you what you can do with it. So that's what he's referencing. And I just randomly picked those names. I don't
oh, I'm sure.
quite yeah. understand why you think it's funny. Those are just some random names. I don't.
We're just trying to find connections where there aren't any, just like right. with Aikman.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
picked some very arbitrary, there's nothing to read into there.
Nothing to read into it at all.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The Tedesco, in one of the cults I came up with, there is a Tom Cruise-like character who I think I called Anthony Tedesco.
Oh, I see.
in the book. And he, I think
that's
is,
amazing.
I don't want to spoil anything, but I think he's secretly a cannibal.
Oh, so it's a little like real life too.
Yeah, exactly. That's yeah, why yeah, I, yeah. my inspiration. I'm like, well, the best cannibal I know is Anthony Tedesco.
Right,
so
right. What you know, and if you know a cannibal, I mean, how are you yeah. not going to work that into your work, especially
exactly.
using their proper name and identifying them as such?
And then, of course, the Esoteric Order of Dagon. There is one of the characters that does have glasses very similar to mine and thinning hair. So mm-hmm. there is a little similarity. There's one that maybe looks a little like you. I didn't have anything to do with the art. That was all Chaosium hiring those guys. They're great. There's
yeah.
really great art in there. I'm very, very impressed with all the artists they got. So I think that might just be a happy accident. I'm not sure if the artist actually knows who I and Chad are, but maybe they do. They might.
Well, folks, make sure you pick that up. It's in PDF form now,
yeah.
and we'll be out next year, and you'll be able to go grab it at the game store. And that's what I'm really looking forward to is that hard copy of it that I can flip
yeah.
through when my phone isn't working. I just need something when the battery dies. Hey, I also want to say there were a lot of nice comments on the end of the Colossus and on our full feature presentation.
Yes!
Which would be boring to read about here, especially near the end of the show. But thank you, everybody that tuned into it. It really meant a lot to me. And if you think about somebody else who maybe is outside of our core audience here who might find it good, I'm thinking about about people who play D&D and are into fantasy stuff who maybe don't, you know, didn't dip into the horror H.P. Lovecraft world right. that we mostly talk mm-hmm. about. Send it to them. Let them know about it, because I'd like to double the amount of people that have seen it.
Yeah, because it's great.
Not for any real huge reason, just for my ego.
And that's enough.
Just being straight
that's
with
enough.
You.
yeah, and I think it's great, and I think lots of people would like it. And there yeah. is that whole D&D world out there that I don't think necessarily listen to our show, so it might get into those guys. Yeah.
And if you do that, we'll play a game at some point and record it.
Yes.
But not till those numbers are doubled. Because then I'll know you want it. Right now.
Oh, boy. So mark that down, Chad, what the number is right now. And when it hits double, we'll do a live game.
I'll mark that down, but I'm going to tell you, you're talking about getting older. I can't see so well. So we don't know what that number is.
Okay, we know. That's true. We don't know. And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to The Comment Show for Strange Studies and Strange Stories.
Here on Patreon. Thanks for tuning in.
HBpodcraft.com.